Coming up next, we have a special recording of three well-known Aboriginal community women in Melbourne speaking at the Women's Health West International Women's Day breakfast earlier this week, including Cookie Yalanji woman Antoinette Braybrook from community-controlled family violence support service JIRA, Aranda writer, journalist, activist and unionist Celeste Little, and Gunai Gunditjmara, former Greens MP, NAIDOC committee chair, spokesperson and activist Lydia Thorpe.
Hello to everybody and welcome to Women's Health West's International Women's Day breakfast. We're waiting at the moment for Auntie Joy Murphy-Wandon, and she hasn't able to get here right now, so my colleague Tracy is going to do an acknowledgement. Thank you, Tracy.
Hi, everybody. I'd like to acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land, of the Wurundjeri land we are on today, and acknowledge and pay respects to our elders, past and present, and acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community people that are with us today. I hope we are able to move forward together to ensure a respectful relationship.
Thanks, Tracy. I'd like to begin by introducing a little bit about Women's Health West and then introduce our speakers as well. For those of you who don't know us, Women's Health West's work encompasses every level of response to violence against women. We undertake programs that are designed to promote women's health, safety and well-being across key areas, or three key areas, of sexual and reproductive health, prevention of violence against women and mental health and well-being. Our family violence services provides women and children with the range of services that they require while in crisis. We also assist women and their children to transition from living with family violence to promoting a healthy, safe and secure life. Women's Health West has actively contributed to improving the health, safety and well-being of women and their children in the western region of Melbourne since 1988. So we had our 30th birthday last year. We're also a member organisation. It's free to join if you work, live or study in Melbourne's West. Women's Health West's own journey towards reconciliation is ongoing. Not just Women's Health West, but certainly in Australia. We still have a long way to go before we close the gap in health outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. And as Antoinette will no doubt highlight, rates of violence against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women is a national emergency. We recognise in light of this that International Women's Day is not necessarily a day of celebration for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. Today we are not focusing on the usual International Women's Day themes. Instead, we focus on equity and justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, on supporting and listening to Aboriginal women leaders. It's a huge honour for us to be able to host these three incredible women this morning, and it's now my pleasure to introduce them. So firstly, Antoinette Braybrook, our first speaker, is an Aboriginal woman who was born in Victoria on Wurundjeri country. Her grandfather and mother's line is through the Kuku Yalanji North Queensland. Antoinette is the CEO of JIRA. JIRA is an Aboriginal community-controlled organisation which provides holistic, culturally safe and specialist legal and non-legal support to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who experience family violence, predominantly women. Our second speaker, Celeste Little, is an Aranda woman who is a writer, journalist, activist and unionist. Celeste is the writer of a well-known blog, beautifully named Rantings of an Aboriginal Feminist, and a contributor to The Guardian and Daily Life, among others. Celeste was inducted into the Victorian Honour Roll of Women in 2017. And finally, Lydia Thorpe is the former Greens MP for the Victorian seat of Northgirt, a Gunai Kurnai Gunditjmara mother and grandmother living on Wurundjeri country. She was the first Aboriginal woman to be elected to Victoria's Parliament. Lydia is also the former chair of the Victorian NAIDOC Committee. So it's now my pleasure to hand over to our first speaker, Antoinette.
Thank you. Can I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land we're gathering on today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Can I also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women here today? And can I take this opportunity to thank Women's Health West for ensuring Aboriginal women's voices and experiences are central at this International Women's Week event. Far too often, our perspectives as Aboriginal women and our participation is an afterthought in conversations about feminism, women's rights, or women's health. And too often, when I speak at mainstream events, I am the only Aboriginal woman on the panel. Like other people, including all of you sitting here, our people also do not speak with just one voice. There is not one Aboriginal view, one singular stance. That is why I'm a strong believer in being inclusive of all voices. So thank you for inviting me to be on this panel with two pretty awesome and inspiring Aboriginal women and two, and they may not know this, that I often look to, Celeste and Lydia. As you heard, I was born here on Wurundjeri country, but my family are Kookyalindji in far north Queensland, and I have been the CEO of JIRA since inception 16 years ago and have lived all of my life out here in the West. This week is about celebrating being women, and while we are having fun, sharing conversation, exchanging anecdotes and getting to chat to other women, let us take a moment to think about the many women who are not able to celebrate. On days like this, I cannot help but think about the many Aboriginal women and Aboriginal mums who are living in fear, in silence, in their homes, on the streets, or behind prison walls. Those who are despairing because their kids have been taken. Those who have no money to buy food. Those isolated, not just because of where they live geographically, but because of their Aboriginality. Excluded, demeaned, marginalised because they are black and because they are women. And because of this, our health deteriorates. Our lives are cut short, our life expectancy several years less than most of you in this room. Today, I want to share with you just how dire the situation is for Aboriginal women, but in doing this, I also want to focus on how we, as Aboriginal women, find strength in each other to survive the extreme injustices inflicted on us, those in the past and in the present. JIRA's work is critical. Everything we do is for Aboriginal women, our mothers, our sisters, aunties, daughters, and our grandmothers. JIRA unequivocally hears, validates, and respects Aboriginal women's voices. JIRA stands as a witness to the injustices of the past and, for many Aboriginal women, the horrors of the present. And yes, we recognise the warning signs of the future if this dramatic change is not forthcoming. The women driving JIRA are the very women JIRA is there for, and I'm just one of the many Aboriginal women JIRA stands for. JIRA builds hope and draws upon the resilience of strong Aboriginal women, women's cultural strength, our shared knowledge, our individual resilience. We revere our traditional role as Aboriginal women. We live with pride and respect. And even as we adapt our cultural life to reflect contemporary times, we have absolute faith in its meaning and value for us. JIRA acts with certainty and clarity of purpose, for we know our mandate, our duty, overcoming the devastation that our women and their children and families continue to experience. We make no apology for keeping what we do our business, Aboriginal women's business. We are protecting and holding firm to our role as Aboriginal women, as nurturers, as the gatherers, as the givers of life, strong as we have always been since the beginning of time, drawing on our traditional ways, our spirit thrives. This is Aboriginal way. Family violence sees lives lost, destroys families, and devastates communities. Everything JIRA does is informed by Aboriginal women's experiences and voices. Our women's unique experience, not only of the violence against them and their children, but also their familiarity with the systems which consistently fail them and which perpetuate the violence that pervades their lives. I want to be very clear. Family violence is not a part of our culture. It never has been, is not today, and for time immemorial, never will be. JIRA is resolute in upholding this principle. So you can understand how far-reaching and devastating family violence is for our women and our children. Here are just some of the statistics. And as you listen, keep in mind the personal stories that lie behind these numbers, the anecdotes, case studies, headlines routinely blasted across the front page. Nationally, today, our women are 32 times more likely to be hospitalised for family violence, and we are 10 times more likely to die from a violent assault than other women. Aboriginal women are more likely to have their children removed than other women because of family violence. Our women today represent 34% of the female prison population, but comprise only 2% of the Australian female population. More than 90% of our women in prison have experienced family violence, and 80% are mums. We, as Aboriginal women, experience extreme levels of intersecting disadvantage and inequality. JIRA will never sugarcoat the story, never let the system off the hook, a system that fails not only our women, but all of our people. This system, constructed over centuries, decades of domination and privilege, does exactly what it intends to do. No mistake or accidental missteps. It's a system designed, purpose-built, to keep our most vulnerable marginalised. Today, instead of many Aboriginal women living in dignity, sharing stories of love, laughter with their children and families, as many others do, we are forced to share a devastation that pervades our everyday lives. Aboriginal women must constantly tell the dreadful and extremely painful stories, the ones behind those statistics that I just shared, so that those in power, those that think they know what's right for our people, might just once listen. This story must change, but it will only change if our people, especially our women, are heard and our women are leading the way. The solutions are there for all of us. The imprint of our world, traditional, cultural, communal, before this present nightmare, remains with us. As Aboriginal women, we were equal to our brothers. Our children taught from birth, loved and protected, our elders respected and honoured. We all had respect for and celebrated our culture, our identity. Roles never questioned. We had our song, our dance, our ceremony. We knew individually where we stood and the law we must follow, our dream time sacred. We preserved the order and the ritual. We accepted responsibility for our actions. And this is where I come full circle now. The mainstream way will never be able to provide that which we need, which we crave, that which will sustain us. But you have a role in this too. Part of it is evidenced by your choice to have three Aboriginal women up front here today, speaking our truth, challenging you and giving you a glimpse into our world, our reality. Aboriginal women, despite such overwhelming odds, are strong, resilient and courageous. Our spirits soar, and we will not allow this next phase of colonisation of our land over 230 years destroy us or our families. JIRA means business, and it is with our women, our families, that we collectively identify the right way. Our roles traditionally have always been equal, and for us, Aboriginal women's business is at the heart of our being. JIRA is a Woiwurrung word for reed. Reeds were used for weaving. Weaving is a time, a special time, where our women come together and share stories and find solutions. JIRA emanates from the aspirations, the wisdom, the experiences, some tragic and many inspirational, of Aboriginal women. And it is this very insight, like a watermark, a pattern of life, which the Aboriginal women of JIRA weave into programs and services and workshops and cultural spaces and submissions to government and all manner of things, with one single intent: to deliver opportunities for safety and for growth and choices and futures, fulfilling and steeped in respect. Thank you.
Thank you, Antoinette, for the ongoing passion and courage and reality and optimism. I think in equal parts, it's really, you're very much a woman that we've looked up to, and both professionally and personally, for a long time. And I very much appreciate your words today. So I am now going to ask Celeste to come and speak with us. Thanks, Celeste.
Good morning, everyone. Before I begin, I'd also like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. I'd also like to acknowledge that we're gathering today on stolen lands, and that these lands have never been ceded, and we still have a long way to go before there is justice for the Wurundjeri people on their own lands. As is protocol, I'll also introduce myself as an Aranda woman whose traditional lands are Central Australia and surrounds. My full name would be Celeste Little Perula, because that's my skin name as well. But I come from a long, proud history of Aboriginal women who were fighters, who were survivors. And I particularly like to acknowledge my grandmother, Emily, who I think through her staunchness and her courage has inspired a lot of the work that I do today. So Just a little bit of intro, just to take on something that Robin said first up about International Women's Day. For me, International Women's Day isn't actually ever a day of celebration, but a day of resistance, and that's how I've always seen it. Much like I see other sorts of events that were built around political resistance, and the origins of International Women's Day come from workers, women workers, fighting for equal pay and for work-life balance and so forth. In fact, it has been known as International Working Women's Day as well, alternately. And it comes from that basis of resistance. And when I think about it in this country, as far as International Women's Day and the relevance to Aboriginal women go, we're still at a point in 2019 where we're not only fighting for equal pay and for work-life balance, but we're actually still fighting to be paid in the first place. And we've got programs like the Community Development Program. You know, 52 years after the Wavehill walk-off, we've got programs that expect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to give their labour freely 25 hours per week all year round, just to receive unemployment benefits. Some of the in some communities, these benefits will also be quarantined on systems such as the Basics Card, and people are being penalised for non-compliance at a rate 70% higher than everyone else. So there's still an expectation that's put on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to provide their labour for free and to continue being happy to do so in order to get the most basic of provisions that everyone else in this country just gets to enjoy. And therefore, for me, International Working Women's Day and the right to fair pay, to conditions, to work-life balance, to being supported by things such as occupational health and safety legislation, to superannuation, to all these sorts of things, that fight is still very much a big fight, definitely for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so the message of International Women's Day and its roots is still very much, for me, one about resistance and trying to draw attention to these issues. I've been an identifying feminist since I was 16 years old. I turned around to my mum, told her I was a feminist, and told her I was never getting married because I didn't want to be owned by anyone, and asked her why she got married as well. And, yeah, that was an interesting conversation. But nearly 41 now, and I've stayed true to that. But the reason why I became a feminist was, as I was growing up Aboriginal and continually having to face racism in the playground, I wrote about it recently in a book called Growing Up Aboriginal, but one of the first things I remember from my schooling was a 5-year-old girl turning around to me and calling me black bum, and me responding to her by pushing her and then being reprimanded because I had shown aggression. And she didn't get reprimanded for racism. So that was the first sort of memory. But as I was facing that sort of racism, you know, that and being called an ABC, I won't translate that. People can ask me afterwards. But, you know, and the N-word and all that, while that was all flying around the school ground, at the exact same time that I was experiencing that, I was also experiencing sexism. So I was experiencing, you don't look Aboriginal enough, followed by you're not pretty enough, you're not this, you're not that, you're supposed to be dainty and look nice, and everything was focused on how I looked or what I was supposed to do or not supposed to do, how I was supposed to curb my intelligence or take a backward step to the boys and not play football against them and all that on the schoolyard. And then you get those sorts of taunts that would go on with that. So I've always conflated racism and sexism from a very, very young age. And therefore, for me, equality in this country won't be achieved until we actually unpack both of them. We really need to deal with racism, and we need to unpack the impacts of colonisation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But at the same time, because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are still impacted by sexism, we need to unpack that as well. There was that. There was also, I myself am a survivor of domestic and family violence, and I found it really hard to struggle to find that voice. But then there's that reality sort of check one time where you're sitting there and you're reading news articles and you realise you're just a statistic. And you're a pretty horrific statistic in that. And so there's a role that, you know, whatever pain you've gone through, that speaking out can actually help assist other people, and using whatever platform you can to do so. Finally, I was inspired by Strong Voices of Aboriginal Women. So my blog, Rantings of an Aboriginal Feminist, came from people that I'd been inspired by
by over the years. There's been so many, but like my grandmother, like Aboriginal poet Lisa Bellair, who was a big impact on me when I was at university. These two women right in front of me here who have, you know, inspired so much of what I do as well. And two older Aboriginal women that when I said to them, I'm thinking of starting up a blog to talk about Aboriginal feminism, they encouraged me to do so. They weren't expecting that 6 weeks after I started it, I'd end up being published, and I wasn't expecting that either, and I'm still wondering how it happened 7 years later. But carving out that sort of space made me feel that it was actually important to continue to take it and to continue to talk about things. Sorry, to continue to talk about the issues on our own basis, using our own platforms, because when it comes to the media, and I've had a long gripe with this, but the media continually controls Indigenous narratives. They will pick voices that are the most that have the most in common with the white patriarchal capitalist status quo, because those voices are the least offensive and going to actually cause the least amount of waves. They also use Aboriginal women in order to continually justify their actions. So when I think about horrific policies such as the Northern Territory intervention, we heard constantly about Aboriginal women suffering in Northern Territory communities, but I can't think of a single example where they actually went and spoke to an Aboriginal woman suffering on a Northern Territory community and gave her a platform. It was all about using invisible Aboriginal women as a justification to then enact oppression upon us. So for me, using whatever platform I can to make sure that those voices are being elevated and then people go and start speaking to those people, if I can enact that through what I do, then I think that's incredibly important, because the media doesn't work in our interest. Finally, I have continued to take up this platform because I'm continually inspired by the fact that Aboriginal women have been leading the resistance for a long time. Whether it's in family and domestic violence, or it's in education, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women have been accessing higher education at a rate double what the men have for a long, long time, or it's, you know, things like Lydia being the first Aboriginal woman to enter the Victorian Parliament. The other one I was going to say was our resistance actions on the street. So me continually being inspired by what was essentially a group of younger Aboriginal women getting out there and organising every single protest that we've had in this city for the past 6, 7, 8 years, and seeing those women up front and being staunch. For me, it's seeing those ongoing resistances, and it's seeing the strength that Aboriginal women bring, not just to our communities but to the entire community in this country. That's the strength that keeps me going and keeps inspiring me to write. And I think I might leave it there. Thank you very much.
You're on 3CR listening to a special recording of three well-known Aboriginal community women in Melbourne speaking at the Women's Health West International Women's Day breakfast earlier this week, including Cookie Yalanji woman Antoinette Braybrook from community-controlled family violence support service JIRA, Aranda writer, journalist, activist and unionist Celeste Little, and Gunai Gunditjmara former Greens MP, NAIDOC committee chair, spokesperson and activist Lydia Thorpe.
Thank you, Celeste. Thank you for continuing to be generous with sharing your stories with all of us over time. I will now pass on to Lydia, who's going to speak and then is going to also MC some questions.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for the invitation. I too would like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people and acknowledge their continued resistance, their continued survival of 230 years of colonisation and survival of genocide and assimilation, where the invaders almost wiped us out but the Wurundjeri people whose land we're on survived and continue to survive and continue to practice their culture and language today. So we're privileged to be on their land today, and I hope that we all remember that and respect that. I'm a Gunai Gunditjmara woman. I come from a very strong matriarchal line. My grandmother set up the Aboriginal Funeral Fund back in the late 60s and early 70s with a number of other Aboriginal women elders in Fitzroy, at a time where our people were being buried as paupers and had no, you know, dignified final resting place. So her and a number of these elders set about to raise money to ensure that our people were buried with dignity, and they were. And her daughter, Elma Thorpe, set up the first Aboriginal health service in Victoria in Fitzroy, which is still existing today after 46 years. And she did that with a number of other strong Aboriginal activists of those days. And the Aboriginal Health Service in 1973 was our political voice. And a lot's changed in 46 years, and we need to get back to our services like JIRA, having more political voices for our people rather than being agents for the government. So, over 10 years of, what is it, 12 years of closing the gap, Aboriginal people in Victoria still suffer alarming rates. Government dress it up, they call it a name, and they choose what the priorities are for us. And then we all start working towards those priorities that the government sets. I will die 9.5 years earlier than all the white women in this room. Why? Because we still suffer the effects of colonisation. And what does that look like? That is, our children continue to be stolen today. We have 2,000 Aboriginal children in out-of-home care in Victoria. As you've heard my sister Antoinette say, our women are being incarcerated at alarming rates. Our land is being destroyed, which is our connection, our song line. We have the lowest incomes. We are the poorest people in our own country. You would think, with such a rich, diverse country such as this lucky country, that we would benefit from some of that stolen wealth over the last 230 years that many, many non-Aboriginal people continue to benefit from today. We don't have wealth inheritance. We have trauma inheritance. 36% of our people are stolen generation or descendants of in Victoria. There's not one Aboriginal person that I've come across that does not or is not affected by this transgenerational trauma that we all experience. To be an Aboriginal person in this country today, it's not easy. And we don't just do our job, going to work, being a mum, raising our family. We also have our community that we need to look after. And when you have people being removed around you, locked up around you, and dying around you as a result of what this country has done to its first people, can be very difficult some days. And if it wasn't for people like Celeste and Antoinette, you know, I wouldn't be standing here today, because it's the women that have kept me strong, not just in my own family, but in my community. We have inadequate housing. We have homeless Aboriginal people in our own country. We have 80,000 people on the public housing waiting list. 97% of Aboriginal Victorians have experienced racism. 97%. And the intervention by child protection is, as I said earlier, it's out of control. And I facilitate the Victorian chapter of the Grandmothers Against Removals, and to have 40 elders sit in a circle and tell their story is absolutely devastating. And this country should be ashamed of allowing our people to continue to suffer at the rate that they do. And so I want to just pay my respects to those grandmothers, continue fight for their children and their grandchildren who don't get any support. And then we have the deaths in custody, where just recently we had a beautiful mother and grandmother die at the hands of police, who was coming to Melbourne on a train, as she would normally do from Echuca, Tanya Day. She died in the police cell. And that's about to go to court. So in terms of support, you know, we need allies to stop this injustice against our people. So this all adds up to poor health and well-being of my people. It's not just the 5 or 6 priorities that Closing the Gap talks about. There's a whole lot of things that need to change for our people to survive and to prosper like everybody else seems to do in this country. We need to start addressing the historical wrongs. We need to understand and learn about the frontier wars. We need to understand the first war that ever happened was on this soil in this country against our people. And this year we held a dawn service to acknowledge that. Down the road from the Shrine of Remembrance, at a known burial site. We all know about the Shrine of Remembrance, and I pay my respects because my grandfathers also were killed in the war. But just down the road from that Shrine of Remembrance is a known burial site of many, many Aboriginal people. And we held that dawn service there to acknowledge the frontier wars and to also acknowledge the continued war against our people. Like, you think about it. When did the war end on our people? When we're still fighting for survival. So we need a health system that caters for our needs the way we decide. We look at life in a holistic sense. And without addressing all those aspects, we won't get anywhere. And just some more on some statistics. 67% of our people live with disability or restrictive long-term condition. 39% of over 50s report poor mental health. 70% rely on government payments as main source of income. 66% of stolen generation people live in households with the 3 lowest income percentages. 40% have experienced homelessness in the last 10 years. And 91% never completed year 12. 62% of workers working age are not employed. And that's just in Victoria. So that's a reality. And there's still hope. Like, we're patient people, we've survived, and we're you know, we're willing to work with people and we're willing to talk about a treaty, which the Victorian government have gone down the path to, but they haven't done it the way it should be done. They've chosen 11 nations out of 38 nations to sit on an assembly, which is not how we operate. You can't exclude people from this process. If you've seen the Victorian language map, you will see there are 38 nations. So we can't have government or government-appointed people deciding who and who cannot participate in a treaty process. And treaty is what I believe, if it's done right, will bring us peace and unite us as black and white in this country. You know, don't leave it up to the government to decide what a treaty is for you. A treaty isn't about just what blackfellas want. A treaty is about what you want. What do you want to see in a treaty? And maybe start thinking about that and putting it to the government, because I'm sure it's things that we want to. So thank you. And now it's time for questions, and I'll invite my sisters Celeste and Antoinette up to our places and open it up. So it's open to you now. If anyone wants to ask any questions, don't be scared. We're amongst friends here, right up the back. Yep.
Thank you for sharing your stories. I guess I'm sitting here like probably everybody else, you know, sitting with the reality of what you've described to us and feeling very ashamed. And I guess sitting with what it is that we all can do moving forward that could make a difference. And, you know, not big things, but little things. I'm interested in whether you could share with all of us if there are things that we can do on a day-to-day basis that might help your community to feel like, you know, you're getting treated in the way that is deserved and right.
I can start. This is working. Look, one of the things I think Lydia actually said incredibly eloquent at the end was people need to think about what treaties look like for them, because this isn't just about you know, us and our needs and how we decolonize after. What, 200 and nearly 30-odd years of an enforced regime upon us. This is also about the fact that there's several millennia worth of knowledge. There's been no compensation for land. There's all these things that, in order for Australia to exist as it exists now, have had to be erased from knowledge, from historical record, from all of that. People actually need to ensure that they're educating themselves and they're seeking answers and they're engaging with the Indigenous communities all across the country, you know. And they're not just taking. I mean, my big beefs with the media. Our voices are continually skewed in order to serve the status quo of this country. So if people are getting out there and engaging and talking with community members, those things soon start being broken down. More people start having knowledge with which to challenge what is the dominant message, and we can start looking at how it is that we all come together to move forward, because that's what treaties are about. They're actually about agreements on how we move forward, and without people educating themselves and taking the time to engage in that grassroots, you know, broadly and ensuring that they've got the messages correct, unfortunately people are just going to continue buying into these very narrow views of what going forward might look like, and that's the last thing we need. We actually need a lot, you know, we need people to actually engage.
Just from a service provider's perspective, we see the many barriers that our women face when trying to access mainstream services. Racism is one of the biggest barriers. When I talk at these events, and I'm sure Lydia and Celeste are the same, it's not about trying to make people feel ashamed of those past injustices, the present injustices inflicted on our people. It's about getting people to really understand and let that inform your practices as a service provider. In the work that we do, you know, we're always about making sure that Aboriginal community control is leading the way. Aboriginal voices, Aboriginal women's voices are leading the way. We see time and time again mainstream organisations going up against us, competing for funding, and then they get the funding and then they come to us and ask us how to do it and deliver it in our communities. That's one very small thing you can do. Don't compete with Aboriginal organisations. Work with us. You know, if you feel that you've got greater capacity than us, work with us. Build our capacity to get that funding and to deliver those services. Let us lead the way.
I am the whitest woman in the world, or the pinkest, actually. One of the things I'd be interested in your perspective is how, you know, both as a family but as a community, how we can work across all of those divides. And at a community level as well as at a, I understand the service provision and I think that's an ongoing battle, but I'm interested at a personal level.
My mother's a Clifton Hill-born Collingwood supporter, which is pretty white. So I get the Urrunda heritage from my father, but the one thing that my mother brought me up with, so I often say that my culture and that comes from Dad, but my pretty staunch politics ended up coming from Mum, because I swear to God, my mum's pretty much an anarchist. And when I was about 15 years old, I think it was, she bought me my first feminism book. So she was... Well, apart from that, she was a sort of woman who refused to let us have, well, particularly her girl children, refused to... Actually, this is a blatant lie, because she let my brother have a doll, but she wouldn't let any of the girls have them because she didn't want us to be trained up to be young mothers. She saw these gendered things that would frame the lives of little girls from a very young age and therefore tried to take them apart. So she was putting these subliminal sorts of messages in. Broader than that too, I learn a lot of my class politics from Mum. So she was, where she didn't necessarily have the first-hand knowledge that I do when it comes to racism, because she would end up having to come to school when any of her kids had been suffering from racism in the class and go toe-to-toe with teachers breaking it down, even though she was the white parent. Where she didn't have that first-hand experience, she made sure that we were bolstered by other sorts of things, so other political movements, making sure that we were strong in our culture, so ensuring that we were engaging in community programs as kids that were being run. At that time, we were living in Canberra, so engaging with local community there. And then same when we moved down to Melbourne. But she was always ensuring that she was building us up. Where she didn't necessarily have the knowledge, she was building us up in other ways in order to be strong. And if it wasn't for that mix between my Indigenous politics and the strong feminist working class politics that I have, I don't think that I would have gotten where I am today. It's been a real sort of, all of those things combined to actually then make a bit of a pain in the ass for the mainstream of Australia. And that, I think that's how you do it. You've just got to make sure that that you're supporting people to grow as strong as they possibly can in the situations that they are.
I'm an Irish woman brought up in the northwest of England, and a feminist. I identified as a feminist very early, as you did, Celeste. I was handed a book by a feminist writer, Australian feminist writer, Anne Summers. And somebody said, read this. This is an Australian feminist. And I read the blurb on the back. And I said to my friend, I said, I want you to sit there now. I want you to pretend you're an Aboriginal woman. And I read the blurb on the back. And it was like, how do you feel now? And she said, invisible. There was no mention at all. It was like feminism started when those boats arrived. But I don't know what to do about that because I'm not Aboriginal. So as a guest in this country, which everybody is if they're not Aboriginal, what do you do and how do you feel, you know, when you, things like that happen?
There's been a constant struggle. So when I first identified with as a feminist, rather, and then I was talking more... So I first identified at 16.
I then went more public in the last, say, seven, or let me try again. I took on a public profile as an Indigenous feminist about 7 years ago. One of the continuing things I got was that feminism is a white movement. It's for white women. And when you look at mainstream feminism, yeah, that happens over and over again. But my rebuttal to that is that white women don't own feminism. And within our own stories, within our own families, within our own cultural groups, we've continuously got stories of strong Aboriginal women who've led the way. You know, even prior, when I think about the fact that our women were knowledge holders and they had specific parts of stories that were passed down generation to generation that were taught in order to ensure that these links remained unbroken over generations. The fact is our women were revered for that knowledge. Our female elders were the carriers of that knowledge and it would continue on. We do need to look to feminism, as I said, as Aboriginal women, because we see this sexism that's now as a form of colonisation, and therefore sometimes our voices end up being supplanted by white mainstream sort of feminists. Other times they can be by Aboriginal men. A lot of the time, though, in the majority, it's usually the white men who will erase all of our voices, and we're continually fighting against that. So for me, the way to break that down is to actually start elevating the voices of Aboriginal women wherever possible. There's so much awesome work being done, you know, whether it's in culture, language revival, family and domestic violence, education. So many things are going on, and there's so many really strong women leading the way that by celebrating and linking in with those voices, it ends up empowering everyone. But yeah, it's still a battle when we do see those sorts of dialogues going on. Feminism does seem to be really white, and we still have to spend a lot of time breaking that down.
Hi, everyone. I am a proud Bundjalung lady from northern New South Wales. I'm Wurundjeri country for 8 years now. I just wanted to say that I volunteer for an Aboriginal organisation. I was an Aboriginal support worker on the Criminal Record Discrimination Project Lydia knows about that dealt with child charges, welfare charges in this country up until the early 90s. But primarily I'm a volunteer because there is no money to even support something that important in this country. It's popular belief that Aboriginal people can't handle money, and so organisations don't get a lot of money unless they take government funding, and in that case we can't challenge areas of government. So when people ask what they can do to be involved, I guess it's also going out and being involved, like actually recognising that we have a really, really beautiful culture, and by not getting to know Aboriginal people, you're really missing out. And, you know, divine feminine is for all of us, it's for all cultures. And I guess for the lady that mentioned something about somebody being too white, it's only because it was actually tried, our skin colour was tried to be bred out by, you know, in early colonisation. And so that's why we have such, you know, we're all black on the inside regardless of how we look on the outside. So that's such an important thing to remember. So I would just say go out and talk to people, talk to Aboriginal women. Don't be afraid, and it's our own things, our own effort and our own heart that will change those things. Thank you.
I might just add to that, being an ex-politician, it would be remiss of me not to mention politics, but also think about who you vote for and put pressure on your politicians. You know, in the short time that I was a politician, the amount of pressure that you get from community is unbelievable, you know, and we need to do more of that, because you can't not answer an email, you can't not answer a letter from your constituents or from your community. You have to respond. So if we all collectively put enough pressure on our politicians to do the right thing, to look at the Tanya Day example where there's a petition to stop this law that is locking our
women up and our people up, and ultimately where our people are dying at the hands of police, to also put pressure on the government about making sure that whatever treaty process that they go down has to be the right one. They can't pick and choose who they want to represent our people. And finally, you know, put pressure on the Uluru Statement. I don't support the Uluru Statement because it was a invite-only process that excluded so many of our people, that had people in that room whose fourth or fifth language was English, with no interpreters in the room. So find out more before you support something that the government or BHP supports. You'd have to start thinking, what's going on here? So put pressure on your pollies, I think, is another angle.
I just wanted to ask, because you've mentioned that education and becoming more aware of what's happening is key into helping bridge the gap and to fix the issues that we're experiencing and that your people are experiencing in this country. If each of you ladies could please just recommend an educational resource that you would say is very... would be helpful in helping to increase our awareness of what's going on, I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
You can contact JIRA, 1-800-105-303. We are developing our cultural safety package to deliver to mainstream organisations. So I'd encourage you to make contact with our organisation. And also you can visit our website that has a number of resources on there.
What I would recommend, using my whole sort of social media sort of stuff, is to actually get onto Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander social media channels to see how we're communicating between each other. So to use our blogs, our Facebook pages, all the rest of the stuff that we use anyway, because we use those things to circumnavigate the mainstream media. And one thing that studies have shown over and over again is that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people use social media at a rate that's 20% higher than what mainstream is, and that's even in our most remote communities. So there's a real opportunity, if people get in there and start networking, that they can get information firsthand from the very communities that it affects, and they can start using that information in order to educate others and circumnavigate, like I said, what is the mainstream media message. So that's a good starting point in my book.
And I have to agree with Celeste. Facebook is my favourite. I always get in trouble for saying the wrong thing on it, but it's certainly where all our people are, whether they've got a job, whether they've got money or resources, they've got Facebook. So I support Celeste. But also one of the things that I've been working on with a number of people is a political museum in Victoria to tell our story from our perspective. You know, this country is in total denial of what's been going on, and we need to have a facility where all people can come and learn the true history of this country.
And that concludes our special recording of three well-known Aboriginal community women in Melbourne speaking at the Women's Health West International Women's Day breakfast, including Cookie Yalanji woman Antoinette Braybrook from community-controlled family violence support service JIRA, Aranda writer, journalist, activist and unionist Celeste Little, and Gunai Gunditjmara, former Greens MP, NAIDOC committee chair, spokesperson and activist Lydia Thorpe.